Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. San Francisco, a city founded in part by criminals, was once one of the most dangerous cities in America. Its Barbary Coast was called a unique criminal district that was the scene of more viciousness and depravity, but it possessed more glamour than any other area on the American continent. San Francisco Notorious brings back the glamorous depravity and noir atmosphere that made it the premier location for murder thrillers like The Maltese Falcon, Vertigo, and Zodiac. This book contains more than 20 compelling tales of serial killers, deadly women, con men, masters of escape, and unsolved mysteries. San Franciscan criminals were as colorful as the city they inhabited. Take William Thornton, a murderous millionaire who hid the nation's largest private armory in his Pacific Heights mansion. Then there's Isabella Martin, the murderous queen of grudges, who tried to poison an entire town. Or Ethan McNabb and Lloyd Samsel, the yacht bandits, who used a luxurious sloop as a getaway vehicle for their dozens of bank robberies. Most of these unusual cases are largely unknown and have never appeared in book form. Included are cases that are still mysteries today, including the mysterious tale of the Zodiac Killer, complete with a new analysis and a startling new theory on the murder. The book that we're featuring this evening is Notorious San Francisco, True Tales of Crime, Murder, and Passion, with my special guest, journalist and author, Paul Drexler. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Paul Drexler.
Yes, thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Thank you very much for joining us. An incredible collection this certainly is. Now, tell our audience a little bit about your background in true crime and how you came to write Notorious San Francisco.
Oh, sure. I've been writing about true crime for a long time, and I came to San Francisco in 1984, and through one of my pieces, I got to be good friends with Kevin Mullen, who was the ex-deputy police chief of San Francisco, and he wrote a number of books, and he had been collecting these things for decades. We collaborated on a number of things. He probably knew more about San Francisco crime than anyone else. And I have inherited his collection and his files, which has been a big help in terms of, finding cases. And I've been doing a lot of interviewing of ex-cops and things like that. So basically, the Bay Area has been my main area of focus, and it's a great area to collect interesting crimes.
Right. Now let's get right into the collection here with a story about Earl Nelson. And you talk about the background of Earl Nelson. He born in 1897.
Yeah.
Tell us about this. As you write it, you talk about there couldn't be a more apt recipe for basically for disaster. You say he was born in 1897. Tell us about his mother and his father and his earliest upbringing.
Sure. Well, his mother died of syphilis when he was 10 months old. Then a few months later, his father also died of the same disease. And, you know, in terms of creating a serial killer or a psychopath, venereal disease can definitely add to that. Then he lived with his grandmother and aunt, and they were very strict Pentecostal Christians. And they were always, you know, railing about the evils of sex. And Earl was kind of a psychotic prodigy. He was expelled from primary school at the age of 7. And he had this kind of strange behavior. He would talk to invisible people. He would quote Bible passages about the great beast. And then he would also peek at his cousin Rachel while she undressed. Now, he developed, he wasn't a big man, but he had large hands and tremendous upper body strength. In fact, he could walk on his hand for blocks. Now, when he was 10, he was hit and dragged by a streetcar, which cracked his skull and put him in a coma. Doctor didn't think he'd survive. And now that's another surprisingly high percentage of psychopaths have experienced serious head injuries as they were growing up.
Right.
So he left school at 14, did a number of manual jobs. He also acquired venereal disease in the brothels of the Barbary Coast. And by 19, he had been in San Quentin, he'd been in the Navy, and he'd been in Napa State Mental Hospital. And Napa State, he kept escaping, and then he'd go back to Napa State. And finally, the doctors there just threw up their hands. I mean, he hadn't improved at all, but they said, oh, he's better, and they just, you know, let him go. And they said he was improved, and, you know, he spent the rest of his life proving his doctors wrong.
Right. You write that in 1925, they finally discharge him, saying he was, as you write, improved, for lack of better prognosis. They said he was improved. Now, in 1926, February 20th, a woman named Clara Newman is 60 years old, and you write as well that after he got out of this prison, out of the hospital, he married, you know, strangely enough, he married this woman that was 58 years old, this Pentecostal spinster. He had these unusual sexual desires or needs. She was not interested. He left that relationship. Now we get to February 20th, 1926. Tell us what happens, where this Earl Nelson is in, that he's in a position to meet Clara Newman.
Sure. Well, there was a landlady named Clara Newman who was showing her attic apartment at her house, and he came in to look at the place. Now, 2 hours later, her nephew came back and found her strangled and violated body in the basement near the oil furnace. And it also, a few weeks later, the same thing happened to Laura Beale, who was a 65-year-old landlady in San Jose. And in both of the cases, the women were sexually attacked after death. So Earl was a necrophiliac. And these killings started what ended up being a nationwide panic. And he was known as the Strangler at this point. And a few weeks later, he killed his third person on Dolores Street in San Francisco. And they started to see the headlines where they say the San Francisco police have had no one like him to contend with in the whole history of the city. So he strangled another woman in Santa Barbara a few weeks later and took her jewelry. And, you know, more descriptions of him surfaced. I mean, people saw him, but no one was really, you know, looking carefully. And they knew that, you know, he was kind of average size. He had these watery blue eyes, a piercing stare, and what they called a ghastly smile on his face. And the newspapers called him the Dark Strangler or the Dark Fiend at this time.
You write about a break in the case in August. And again, this fear has gripped his community. And they find a person named Philip Brown. They pick him up as a vagrant in Needles, California. What happens, and why do they think this is a break in the case?
Well, they think it's a break in the case. And you know, it's really hard when the serial killer is killing people he doesn't know and just sort of appears and disappears. But they had a witness this time, this guy William Franey, who was a fireman. And he identified as the strangler, he saw him attack this woman, Mrs. Russell. It was a kind of unusual situation because he saw the attack on Mrs. Russell as he peeked through a keyhole in the door. So to reproduce those conditions, they put Brown in a room and had Franey peer through the keyhole, and that's how he identified Brown. And, you know, Brown had a history of epilepsy and attacks. The police chief and district attorney were convinced they had the right guy. But the guy did not meet the physical characteristics. And the more and more they talked to him, the more and more they wondered about his mental condition. As the days went on, his whole story unraveled, and he was sent to a mental hospital. And, you know, the search continued. And there became anyone who moved into town or had a dark complexion, was from another country, or just unknown, was automatically a suspect. A few weeks later, in Santa Cruz, they arrested this stocky foreigner, and they were a lynch mob was threatening him and told Merton Newman, who was the guy who was the nephew of the first woman killed, came down and said, no, that's not the guy. So these continued. Nelson returned to San Francisco. He strangled this woman who had a house for sale, and he left her naked body under the bed. The next day, though, there was another woman, Mrs. Murray, who was 8 months pregnant, was approached by him. And there's something about him that put her at just made her nervous. And this is also, you know, a good thing to remember, that if you have a bad feeling about someone, listen to it. So the whole time she was showing him through the house, and he was asking all kinds of questions about its construction, but she stayed 6 to 8 feet away from him. And then finally he was going to leave. She turned to open the door, and he attacked her. And she fought back. She raked her nails against his face and made it to the street. He fled, but she was able to give the police a very, you know, clear description of him. And you know, one of the reasons that he was asking all about the house, part of his method of operating, was he would start asking about the house so he could get the landlady downstairs away from anyone else. You know, he'd ask about the furnace or this and that. And once he got her into the furnace room, that was it. That's when he'd kill her.
You write about the media.
Excuse me?
Ahead. You read about the media being very confident once they had that description from this woman that escaped his clutches.
The San Francisco Chronicle, not one of their better predictions. They said, description of strangler now complete, arrest certain. They were, let's say it was overly optimistic. It took about 15 more bodies and a year and a half for this to happen. And then he started going east.
Where did he go? You talk about Oregon and Washington.
Yeah.
He
went to Oregon,
Washington,
killed a woman in each city. I'm sorry. And then he started going east. He killed a woman in Council Bluffs, Iowa. He killed a woman in Kansas City. And then the next day he killed and raped a woman and her 8-month-old son. Then he disappeared again. And by this time, the press had come up with a new name for him, which was the Gorilla Killer, because he had very large hands and kind of his posture was kind of ape-like. And it was in all the newspapers. In fact, in Philadelphia, where he also struck, they featured a 3-page, you know, column entitled "How to Escape from the Strangler," with photos, you know, sort of showing you what to do. Then he started going west. He went to Buffalo, killed someone, killed two women in Detroit, and he killed a woman in Chicago. And by this time, police were after him everywhere. You have to, you know, remember that in pretty much every city he did this, there would be this huge search of the entire populace. But by this time, it was getting pretty hot for him, so he decided to go into Canada, which he did.
Now, you write about June 5th, You write about June 5th because this acceleration, his frenzy, this killing frenzy, May 3rd, May 30th, June 1st, June 3rd. Now June 5th, he hitchhikes to Winnipeg, Canada. And as you write, it's the third largest city in Canada at that time. Gets a job as a construction laborer. What's his alias? And again, what does he do once he's in another country and on the run from U.S. officials?
Sure. He had a number of aliases. This one was Roger Wilson. And the other thing to remember is that he knew the Bible, and he posed as a very religious man. And, in fact, he told this woman, "I want quiet surroundings where I can reflect. A man with Christ in his heart need worry about nothing else." She was very impressed, Mrs. August Hill, with his piety. But 2 days later, this 14-year-old girl who was selling artificial flowers on the street disappeared. The next day, Nelson went to another rooming house, and he asked for a room. He said he didn't have any money, but that he'd do odd jobs to pay. Now, when her husband came back, she was missing. Emily was missing, the landlady. And a few hours later, he discovered her body underneath their bed.
Mm-hmm.
And this was really when police really started mobilizing. They realized that he was in the city. And they knew more about him, so they started checking every boarding house. And when they reached Mrs. Hill, she described her tenant, Roger Wilson, as a short, dark, religious man. And they searched his room and found the decaying body of Lowell Cowan under his bed. So this really kind of exploded everything.
You talk about the national response in Canada to this and the news of this broadcast throughout the country. But you write about that the Strangler heads west to the capital of the neighboring province, which is Regina, and he rents a room from Mrs. Rowe. What does he do in Regina while authorities still think he's somewhere in Winnipeg and they're looking everywhere?
So, I mean, it's a big country, so he's moving around. Well, Mrs. Rowe had a 9-year-old daughter, and the next morning he bought her an ice cream cone, and he tried to lure her into going into a side street with him. And she made definitely the greatest decision of her life by refusing to do that. Obviously, that did save her life. But by this time, he had been tracked into Regina, and searches were pouring into the city. So he went back to Manitoba, and he headed south. They figured that he was going to head back to the United States and try to get a train.
Mm-hmm. So he's sighted about 40 miles north of the border by a constable, and you describe that it's just a little small town, and he's alerted that there's a stranger in town. What happens in this exchange between this constable and Earl Nelson?
Yeah, so this constable, it was this guy, Constable Gray of Killarney, which is a town of 1,000, very close to the border, and there was a train station in the town. So Constable Gray talked to this guy, gave his name as Virgil Wilson. He agreed to come to the police station, and he was so relaxed that Gray could hardly believe he was the wanted man. But Gray took away his belt, his shoes, his socks, and locked him in a cell and handcuffed him to the bars. And then he went to the next room to get a phone, and he called. Inspector Smith was in Winnipeg, was the overall head of the search. He called Wilson, and he told him the name, his alias, and Wilson said, "Don't let him out of your sight. I'll be there tomorrow morning." And Inspector Smith assembled 50 police to go with him on a special train. So when Gray gets back, he found the cell door open and handcuffs dangling from the bar.
Wow.
Nelson had picked the locks with a nail file that he found on the floor. So, the town was gripped by panic. Most of the women and children spent the night in a church guarded by dozens of armed men. It was a 500-man posse going from house to house, but he spent a peaceful night hidden in the loft of a farmer's barn. just a block from the police station.
Incredible.
And, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So the next morning, you say that they had been staking out train stations because they felt that that's the way he would get back into the U.S. Were they correct, and what happens at this train station the next morning?
Okay, well, you know, he gets out of his hiding place, and he makes a break for the train station, and the train is pulling into town. And a mob of people see him, and they chase him. A guy grabbed him, but he broke free. The train doors opened, and he ran in. Now, unfortunately for him, the train was the train commandeered by Inspector Smith. There were 50 police who poured out of the train, and they engulfed him. They took him back on the train and headed back to Winnipeg. And you know, there was a crowd that would very much have liked to lynch him. But they did get back to Winnipeg. And after some questioning, he admitted that he was Earl Nelson.
You write about the extraordinary search for the Dark Strangler. You say it had occupied more police in more cities than any other case in history. San Francisco, San Jose, Portland, Kansas City, Philadelphia, Detroit, Chicago, and then Winnipeg. What was his fate in 1928 in Winnipeg?
What was his... Oh, well, it finally... They finally got him, and he was hung in Winnipeg after killing about 23 women, most of them landladies. So I would say after that, the landladies all over the Western Hemisphere were very grateful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now let's talk about another story from this collection, The Grandma from Hell. And you... Open with this, with a detective, John Kaufman, investigating the disappearance of a Santa Rosa motel owner, Mildred Arneson. Tell us about John Kaufman's encounter with the grandma from hell, Iva Kroeger.
Yeah, Iva Kroeger was, I would call her a psychopath. She was, you know, she looked very unsuspicious. She was sort of middle-aged, short, very dowdy clothes, squint in an eye, but she loved to talk. There was this cascading stream of words and sentences. She talked about a psychic. She was very into spiritualism. She talked about how good she was at business and also her health. She was always something wrong with her. At this time, she was talking about he was in a bus accident in San Francisco and she was crippled. You know, so if you talk to her, you think, you know, here's this woman practically on her last legs, and she'd say these crazy things, but, you know, you sort of think she was a harmless person. It's like, you know, the scariest movies, at least that I've seen, are the ones that move, all of a sudden everything's normal, and then the next minute your Uncle Tom, who seems like such a nice guy, is growing fangs. You know, and this was Iva Kroeger. You know, she'd be very sweet, and then the next minute she's got a gun pointing at your heart and she's threatening your life, and you know that she means it. So Kaufman talks to her. He was investigating the disappearance of a motel owner in Santa Rosa. And this woman, Mildred Arneson, she was a real estate investor who owned this motorhome called the Rose City Motorhome with her ex-husband. And Mildred was a Rosicrucians, and she told her family that she was going to South America with another spiritualist named Iva Long. So when Kaufman went to the motel, he found Iva Long was running it, and she denied that she was ever going to accompany Mildred. She said that Mildred was somewhere in South America. And, you know, she claimed to be a psychic. He was suspicious, but she showed the deed that transferred the motel, and it was genuine. So there was nothing much to do at that time. But Mildred had a family of sisters and brothers, and they kept calling police, and they were very suspicious. They got a letter supposedly from Mildred that appeared to them to be like a phony. And Iva, her, Jay, who was Mildred's husband, disappeared a few months later. So, and Iva had this wild story about where he went. And they continued to investigate, but they really couldn't do much until Iva had a dispute with a guy trying to collect an overdue bill. And this really revealed a lot about him. He was a guy who sold water softening systems, and she convinced him to loan her money. And finally, he asked for his money back, and she took him on a wild goose chase to all these places where she said she had money, but whenever she got there, there was some other reason. So he goes back to the motel, and he did a very smart thing. He was with his wife, and he told his wife, wait about 10 minutes and then come and get me. So he goes into her office, and she pulls a gun from under the desk and points it at his heart, and she says, sign this receipt that says paid in full. And, you know, if you don't, we'll carry you out of here feet first, and no one will ever know what happened to you. At that point, his wife knocked at the door, and he was able to get away, and police were called, but she just disappeared. They learned that Iva Long was not her real name. Her real name was Iva Kroger, and she had been married 3 times. She had been a grifter. So that's who she was. And, she was just a real con artist. She would tell people she had leukemia, she'd go blind, she'd get money for various things. And she was suing the bus company.
You write about that she was on the run from insurance and investigators and their creditors. And so they were staking out racehorse tracks and astrologers to try to find her.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally tracked down her son in Fort Myers, Florida. What did her son tell police about his mother?
Yeah, this is a scary story. He said his mother came to him, and she hadn't contacted him in years. And she said that she was a wealthy widow, and she owned a motel in San Diego. And she offered her son a job at his motel. And then she said, well, you know, why don't I take your kids, who were 2 boys, 3 and 4, for a little overnight trip. And he agreed, and then she and the boys disappeared. And there's this nationwide search. And her husband had no idea where she went. One of the things about the book is I have a lot, I talk about the addresses, the places where these crimes happened, and most of those places are still there. And most of the people who live in those places have no idea what happened because it was so long ago. So the police were suspicious. They heard that she had hired someone to dig a hole in the basement of her house.
Right.
And they got a search warrant, and they began excavating the basement. And they discovered the body of Major Arnson, and next to him, they discovered the body of Mildred Arnson. And that's when they arrested Ralph on suspicion of murder. And then her grandchildren were found wandering the streets in Oakland. She just abandoned them. So there was an all-points bulletin out for her. And there was a couple in San Diego, a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses, who met her. And they noticed her resemblance to the photographs in the newspapers about this case.
Mm-hmm.
And they told the FBI who captured her.
When they do arrest her, despite all this evidence, despite the bodies buried in the home, and Ralph's insistence that he didn't know anything about this whatsoever, him being a much older, 17 years older than her, What did she say in response to these charges? What was her excuse?
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. You could never, you know, she had an answer for everything. You know, she says, oh, a blackmailer was responsible. Somehow, you know, a blackmailer broke into the house and buried these two people. Obviously, it didn't convince the police. And, you know, she and her husband were charged with murder. And it's, you know, it's really hard to claim that you're innocent when the bodies are buried in your basement. So the defense was going with that she's not legally guilty because she's crazy. And she once told someone, if you act crazy, you can get away with anything because people will think you're eccentric. And that became her courtroom strategy. I mean, I don't know that there's ever been such a crazy trial. You know, because normally, you know, the judge is in charge and people talk when they're spoken to. She just said whatever she wanted, whenever she wanted. She interrupted. She argued with witnesses. She threw things. She sang. She fell asleep in the middle of the trial. She did all these crazy things to convince the jury that she was crazy.
You write that in 1966, the press, she had some attention. In 1971, she got some attention again for writing poetry from prison.
Mm-hmm.
What about parole in 1975?
Yeah. Well, you know, she was originally sentenced to death, and then it was changed to life imprisonment. And the judge said, this person should never be released, but... Mm-hmm. She was. She is in prison. She convinces people that she's legally blind. She's, you know, she writes poetry. She does all these things and to endear herself. And after about 14 years in 1975, because of good behavior in the California sentencing laws, she was paroled. She became a Scientologist and took classes in sociology. She said that she wanted to be a nurse. That was always, she used to pose as a nurse. That was her favorite dodge. So she goes to nursing school, and she used to visit her brothers in Florida. Now in 1986, she meets this nurse on a bus. And she steals the nurse's identification and gets a series of jobs in Florida.
Yes. She did have, her criminal career did not end there as well. You talk about threats to her nephew's business partner as well.
Her nephew's son drowned in a swimming pool. And I have a, you know, she was psychotic, really, and she blamed that the son's death on her nephew's business partner, you know, on the grounds that if he hadn't been at work, he would have prevented the death. And she called her husband's business card, her nephew's business partner, and threatened to kill him. And she said, if you don't believe me, check the records. I've killed before. So she even conned a cop into giving her a lift. When the police finally realized who she was, she had already left the area. And
yes.
She was sighted in Santa Rosa years later, but no one, she really pretty much disappeared. They only found out about her death. She died in Massachusetts in the year 2000. And they only found out about that after she died. So who knows what she did before she died. But she was quite an extraordinary criminal in person.
Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second, talk about our sponsor, which is Honey. You ever buy something online only to find out later you missed a discount? I don't overspend anymore thanks to Honey. Honey's a free browser add-on that finds me the best deals online. The app magically auto-applies the best deal to my cart at checkout. And Honey finds discounts and coupons across 37,000 sites. Amazon, Sephora, Best Buy, Nordstrom, and more. I just used Honey the other day to order a book called Chaos from Tom O'Neill about Charles Manson and the CIA. It was $26. With Honey, I saved $4, almost 15%. I was impressed with this being the very first thing that I ordered. I'm excited about my next purchase. Honey has saved its 10 million members an average of $28.61. Honey members have already saved more than $800 million. Not bad for something that's completely free and takes just two clicks to install. Honey has over 100,000 five-star reviews on the Google Chrome store. Time magazine calls Honey basically free money. Look, there's no reason not to use Honey. It's free to use and easy to install on your computer in just two clicks. So shop with confidence. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/murder. That's joinhoney.com/murder. Honey, the smart shopping assistant that saves you time and money when you're shopping online. Another incredible story in your collections of stories from San Francisco is one called Manhunt, the Joe Tankle story. And this is a go back in time a little bit to September 1923. And a couple guys, Joe Tankle, 24 years old, and Floyd Hall, 21. Tell us a little bit about their backgrounds and how they eventually meet up and then begin this incredible crime spree.
Sure. Well, at this time they were robbers, and they fatally shot the police chief of San Bruno, and they were caught later when Tanka wrote a letter to his brother in which he admitted to doing 40 robberies and to killing the police chief. Now, his brother, as a good citizen, gave this to police, told police. For the rest of his life, Tanko threatened his brother's life. But they were very young guys, and they pled guilty, so they weren't given the death penalty. They received a life sentence instead.
Now, you talk about them en route to San Quentin. They made their first escape attempt. Tell us about that first escape attempt and if that dissuaded them from pursuing escape again.
No, there was a sheriff saw what they were doing and stopped them. Now, you know, escape artists are, you know, they're very glamorous because they're doing things that are so difficult. And being foiled did nothing to deter them. In fact, a year later, they picked a lock. This is in San Quentin. And they slid down a jute rope. And while police and posse searched for them, they broke into a number of stores in Petaluma and Healdsburg. They got food, guns, supplies, and then they went on this wild crime spree. So they carjacked Santa Rosa rancher on April 14th. They held up a Sacramento cab driver. They had a big shootout with Sacramento police. And then a few days later, while police were staking out the highways around Sacramento, they robbed this guy's store, killing him in the process. And police from the neighboring communities flooded in, but they couldn't be found. They robbed a couple of cab drivers. They kidnapped this guy and his four-year-old daughter and got into a gunfight with police, and they severely wounded a police officer. And then they drove on till the car ran out of gas, and they fled on foot. And there was a massive manhunt. It was, I think, the largest manhunt in California history, 1,000 armed men following them.
Wow. Now, what's the next thing they do in May involving a carjacking again? What do they carjack this time?
This time they carjacked a U.S. mail truck in the town of Gold Run, and they made this drive down the mountain towards Sacramento. And they got a flat tire, and they abandoned the truck, and they disappeared into the mountain area. 200 deputies surrounded the area. I mean, the police were going crazy because they had put so many resources. They couldn't understand how these guys kept slipping through them.
Mm-hmm.
But Tank One Hall stole another car, and they came back to Sacramento on May 4th.
There's a big reward, you say $6,000 at that time in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
What do Hall and what do they decide to do, Hall and Tanko, to avoid capture?
Well, they decided, you know, that they probably should split up. You know, their chances would be better. They were single. And what happened to Hall was, you know, he was looking for a place to hide. He talked to a guy, an ex-con he knew, and he was hiding in that con's room, but the con turned him in to the police for the reward money. Tanko disappeared. And by this time, they were just, you know, almost heroes. They certainly were celebrities. And Hall, who was going on trial, got all this great press. You know, captured desperado, sobs at mention of his family, is one of the subheads. And they keep searching every rooming house in Sacramento. But Tanko goes to San Francisco. He carjacks, he kidnaps a guy in Golden Gate Park. The guy drives to North Beach, and Tanko jumps out and disappears again. But meanwhile, Hall is indicted for the murder, for the murders he's committed. He's convicted and sentenced to death. But the case is appealed, and he gets a new trial. And somehow, in 1926, he's acquitted of the shooting of Nunn.
Wow. Now, you talk about the continued manhunt for Joe Tanko.
Yeah.
And you say he was living in Denver.
Yeah, he's living in Denver. He's got a girlfriend there who doesn't know his real identity. He's telling her that he's a San Francisco businessman, and I suppose you could say that's true, only his business is robbing and murder. You know, the fear, I mean, there's a whole headline about Tanko invades, like one person invades a whole city. So, but after living in Denver and doing all these criminal things, he decides to go back to San Francisco in October 1926 to see his other girlfriend, who knows who he really is. And in November, on November 13th, there was this police sergeant, Vernon Van Matre. He's got this order to arrest this guy, Willie DeBartlin. This guy and his gang had committed assault on a man and his wife. And this was at 1373 McAllister Street, which is still there. So he didn't, you know, expect a lot of trouble, but he brought along a few other cops to block the other exits in case they decided to make a run for it. So Matre raises the window. He comes in. He tells DeBartlin, you know, hands up. The building is surrounded. Come up with your hands out. And DeBartlin stands up and says, "I can't, he's got me covered." And as Van Matre, the cop, enters the room, he gets shot by Joe Tanko, who had been hiding in the apartment.
Right.
And Tanko runs up the stairs. As he comes up the stairs, he comes face to face with Detective Sergeant Rooney, who asked him to surrender. I wouldn't have done that, but anyway, he asked him to surrender. Tanko fires. He hits Rooney in the stomach, but Rooney fires back 5 times, and he kills Tanko instantly.
Mm-hmm.
And when the news of the shooting got out, there were huge crowds, and 20,000 people visited the coroner's office to view Tanko's corpse.
Wow. Now, you get back to Hall being acquitted at the second trial, or pardon me,
yeah,
he has that second trial. So what happens amazingly at this second trial and why?
Yeah, well, you'd think, okay, this is it. But he is acquitted in the second trial. They decide not to retry him because he's already serving a life sentence for the first murder.
Right.
So for the next 10 years in the 1930s, he tries to escape every few years. And he's caught. But gradually, this is when we get to 1956. Now this is 30 years after the robberies and killings.
Mm-hmm.
He's finally let out of prison on parole. And, you know, he had a lot of charisma, and that's often true of these guys. So he gets out of jail, and amazingly enough, this guy, Hall, who killed the police chief, killed that other guy, shot, committed 100 robberies, armed robberies, he gets a full pardon in 1972 with the help of the lobbyist who fell under his charm, and was Ronald Reagan who gave him the pardon. I'm sure Reagan knew, you know, didn't know really his background.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he went to this this place called the Brass Rail, which was a hangout for lobbyists, and he gets to know everyone in, within an hour, and everyone really likes him. And there it goes. He gets a full pardon and dies, you know, without a record. It's quite extraordinary.
Incredible. You talked about, too, that incredible, the exchange where he goes to that Brass Rail for an hour and charms these people enough to get, incredibly, a full pardon from Governor Ronald Reagan. Incredible.
Yeah. It's, you know, I wonder what he said. But, you know, they're, you know, cops are great storytellers and so are criminals. So I'm sure he had great presence. He's a good-looking guy. And, you know, I think he just wowed them. And they were, I think they found him so interesting and really didn't think about what he had done or it was so long ago. You know, this is like a different person facing them. But whatever he said, it certainly worked.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about Ethan McNabb and Lloyd Samsel, the yacht bandits. And what was it about this story that was so remarkable for you to include in this? Tell us a little bit about this pair.
Sure. McNabb and Lloyd Samsel, they were two of the most extraordinary men that criminals that I've ever read about because they were brilliant, they were talented. They could do, you know, they were expert sailors. They were expert writers. They could pretty much do anything. They could even make a gun out of spare parts. And but there are these two guys who would never go straight. They liked that life. They liked the craziness that went along with them. In fact, Ethan McNabb, at the age of 9, he was living in Deadwood, South Dakota. And he was already playing hooky. He was living in a cave. He was, you know, committing little burglaries. You know, at the age of 9, he gets sent to the reform school. And he and Samsel meet in 1922 when they're both sent to San Quentin for a number of bank robberies. And they decide to partner up when they get out, which is about 1926, and they are very good at what they do. They are bank robbers, and they bought a yacht with some of their, they robbed well over 100 banks, and they bought a yacht with some of the money they made, and then they pretended to be these wealthy yachtsmen, and they knew how to sail a yacht, and they would take the yacht to a city, rob the bank, get back on the yacht, sail down the Pacific. They rob banks from Vancouver to San Diego.
What was part of the lure, or pardon me, the charm of these two people once the media caught wind of this entire, this duo's adventures?
Well, they were very suave. They were, you know, great dressers. It was, well, you know, Lloyd Senzel had something. He had real charisma because one of the people he robbed, this is around 1922, the president of the bank that he robbed, that he personally held a gun to, wrote to Samson's father and said, well, I don't think he's really a criminal. He seems like, you know, if he gets a break, I'm sure he'll go straight. And, you know, it takes a lot of charisma to get someone on your side who you've pointed a gun at. So they definitely had something. And they were also very, very smart. And they immediately, you know, decided to escape. They were not going to stay in jail. And Lloyd Samsel came up with one of the most amazing plans that I've ever heard of. And
absolutely.
What he did was he designed a hiding space. It was about 8 by 10 feet that had food, water, it even had a battery-powered flashlight. And his idea was that they were going to hide in the prison. And then they figured, okay, the guards are going to search like crazy for a few days. Then they'll figure, okay, these guys got out of prison, and they're looking everywhere else for them. And then kind of when the heat's off a little bit, they will get out of their hiding place and escape. And to add to their, you know, odds, they bribed a couple of the prison officials to let them out. But they were double-crossed by these prison officials. And after 9 days, the prison officials led the warden to where they were. Of course, they never said they had been bribed. They said, oh, we just discovered this. And it was just in time because they were almost dead from lack of air. But they were still there, and they were, you know, of course, beaten and put in solitary for a long time. But that did not stop them. After that, there was a plot that they had to someone to smuggle a lot of guns in. Finally, after about 3 attempts, the warden decided to separate them, and they sent McNabb to San Quentin, and Samson stayed in Folsom.
But that didn't stop them from trying to escape separately, did it?
No, it didn't. In fact, it was Samson. In the machine shop, I don't know how he did it, but he actually manufactured a working firearm and ammunition. I don't know if he made the ammunition or he got it, but he did definitely made 2 working firearms. And he and this other guy decided, you know, to escape, and they had this plan to lure the warden into the building where they hold him, and the warden felt that something was wrong, and he refused to come in, and he surrounded the place. And when they were about to be captured, Samson's partner just shot himself, killed himself with the weapon that they had manufactured. Now, a year after that, McNabb did exactly the same thing. He had actually more guys. He made a gun, made a number of guns. He had about 10 people involved in the break. And while he was doing the break, he accidentally shot and killed a prisoner. And this was also foiled. It was a foggy night, and they were carrying this ladder, and he was dressed in a guard's uniform. But the guard up in the tower didn't believe him. And they were captured, and there was a law that if you are involved in an escape and someone dies, it's a capital offense.
Right.
And he was sentenced to death. But in his last week, he wrote a book that he gave to his lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And a very cool character. And you know, he read a poem before he was executed, and that's how he went. Lloyd lived on for years after that.
Mm-hmm. You say that,
and
you write that he.
Yeah, sir.
You write the night before his execution, Samsel talked to reporters, and they said, "They say I've led a wasted life, but I have a son. He's 6'3" and 170 pounds. He's married, got two kids. He's in the service, so I have left something good." And he turned to the nearly 100 witnesses. What did he do at that execution that was interesting?
Well, he winked. You know, they had style, if nothing else. And, you know, they were quite extraordinary people. There's a lot more that he did. He managed to get out of the road crew when he was on during the war and visit his girlfriend. But, yeah, they had a lot of guts and they had a lot of style. But they both were executed by the state.
Absolutely.
And Carol Chessman, actually, were running the death row at that time. They certainly knew each other well.
It's incredible you write, too, about the skill sets of both of these people. Again, when we mentioned earlier about how some people theorize, well, that if they would have just had some opportunities, they would have led a life, an alternative to their criminal life. But as it shows in this case, they had quite a bit of skill set, and despite that. Correct?
Yeah. And this guy, Willie Sutton, who was a very famous bank robber and escape artist, said that, you know, I was never more alive than when I was robbing a bank. I loved everything about it. And even if he got a big haul, a few weeks later he'd start casing the next one. It was a thrill, you know, that they were after. And there was no way that they were going to stay law-abiding. It didn't give them enough kicks.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you, Paul, for coming on and talking about Notorious San Francisco, True Tales of Crime, Murder, and Passion. Do you have a website that people might take a look at?
Yes.
Is there a Facebook page? Tell us about that.
Yes, there's a website that's called Crooks Tour, and then my book has a website. It's called San Francisco Notorious. You can get it on Amazon. And I actually do occasional crime tours of San Francisco, so you can check the website for any future ones.
Also, just wanted to ask you about the fantastic trading cards.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've created these trading cards. I figured it would be, you know, nice to have cards like, you know, like baseball cards, but also to do the stats. So, for example, I have a guy named Chicken Divine who, looking at his police record, he was arrested 79 times in 5 years.
Wow.
And I figured out how many times he was arrested, how many times he was convicted, you know, and came out with a criming average. And all of it, they're in this. These cards are, half of the cards are people who I write about in the book. There's a total of 10, and you will definitely learn about a lot of interesting people. And I would say, I think 3 or 4 of them are women. So San Francisco has a great tradition also of women murderers. We're, of course, very proud of that also.
Yes, absolutely. Again, I want to thank you very much, Paul Drexler, for coming on and talking about Notorious San Francisco, True Tales of Crime, Murder, and Passion. You have a great evening.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good night.
Sure.